He is one of South Africa's top labor lawyers. He is a politician and member of parliament. And now you can access Michael Bagrum as he talks law and life on High FM. Join Michael Bagrum at 6 p.m. for Bagrum on Law and Life, 101.9 High FM, 101.9 megahertz of life and law.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for joining us this evening. I really appreciate it. It's Michael Bagrum every single Tuesday evening between 6 and 7. We've always got an interesting guest, and I will introduce you to him just now. But like I do every single Tuesday evening, I look at a book that I've been delving into, trying to read, trying to understand. A book every week I read something, and this week I'm reading a new book, and I'm quite excited about it. It's called The Essence of Success. It's by Greg Mills. I'll tell you a little bit about him, and Emmanuel Pirro. Both of them are fantastic authors in their own right. Greg Mills is someone who was employed by the Brenthurst Foundation. He worked for the Oppenheimers for many years. He did research for them, in particular into politics in South Africa. He did research into the forthcoming elections each year, different types of the different spheres of government. He had a look at international politics. He's been writing some interesting stuff on Ukraine, obviously on the Middle East, and he has now left the Brenthurst Foundation. It's closed down. I'm not sure why it closed down, but the Oppenheimer's closed down, and he has gone, obviously, in on his own. He has done some enormous research into everything, and the book is absolutely wonderful read. It's just come out. It's been out for about a month. I was one of those first that run out and go and buy a copy of this book because I was so interested, and I follow him quite a bit. What is interesting is that this book itself is looking at politics, but around the globe, not just South Africa, and is, of course, the essence of success. So he's looking at what countries do well, what businesses do well, what individuals do well, and what is the secret. What I found interesting is he had a quote from Ehud Barak. Remember, he was the Prime Minister of Israel, 1999 to 2001. Ehud said about this book when he read it, "In the digital age, politics has become a contest between appearance and reality. This book shows how to successfully bridge this divide." And in reading the book, I'm starting to understand what Barak had to say and why he said that. But I think you go and get yourself a copy and have a look at this. It makes for fascinating reading. So over to my guest this evening. And my guest is a fellow who might be known to many of you already and probably friendly with half of our listeners. It's Stephen Goldberg from Johannesburg. A lot of my guests are from Cape Town. So here we have someone from Johannesburg. I had one of our listeners complain a few weeks back saying that I'm only interviewing people from Cape Town. They said, no, the best people come from Johannesburg. Well, I found Stephen, and Stephen was willing to give us a little bit of his time. Stephen and I go back quite a few years, and we'll talk a little bit about some of our adventures together at the Kruger Park walking, on the Whale Trail walking, walking on Table Mountain, etc., and, of course, sharing some downtime, not walking, but having a cool drink and a piece of cake and maybe holidays together. So, Stephen, thank you very much for giving of your time this evening. And I know that in your early days, you sort of partially retired. I don't think fully yet, but partially retired. I want to use that time that I've got with you to tell us about your career, some of the interesting exploits you've had over the years, some of the interesting clients that you've worked for, and of course, some of the things that you felt are worth talking about and worth memorializing, if there's such a word, and your legal career behind you, and hopefully we're going to hear more from you in the legal world in the future anyway. So Stephen, just give us a little bit of the taste of your history. Where were you brought up? Where did you school, university, that sort of thing, so that People know the man, Stephen Goldberg.
Thank you very much for your very kind introduction, Bags, and good evening to the listeners as well. So I was born in Vanderbijl Park, Vereeniging, and grew up there, and then moved to Johannesburg to start high school. But I went to Northview High School, then did my army training. In June 1976, started as the Soweto riots were happening, and I fortunately was doing my basics. So I wasn't allowed out of the camp. And Vanderbijl Park is surrounded by Boipoteng, Sebokeng, and Sharpeville. At the time, you know, 3 years after I was born, a lot of stuff was happening there, but I don't think the coverage or my parents knew what was going on outside of the town. Went to Wits University, studied law, did my articles of clerkship at I was a candidate attorney at a general law firm, did a lot of general things. And at the end of my articles, I interviewed for a position at a firm called Spoer and Fisher. I did not know anything about them. I did not know what they did. But I did a bit of research and I found out that they were a specialist law firm doing intellectual property law. So I thought they offered me a job as an associate, and I thought I would work there for 6 months to see, I knew nothing about that area of law, to see what it was like. And after 41 years at the firm, I eventually retired.
A well, very happy experience. Certainly a loyal guy, that's for sure. I don't know many people that were able to work for someone for 41 years, but you probably got the gold cufflinks at the end. People like me who worked for myself didn't get the cufflinks. But if I can go backwards a little bit, and could you tell us, first of all, what intellectual property is? Well, what does it entail, and why is it a specialty? Well, what's it all about? There will be people like me that don't fully understand it.
Okay. So just before I go into that, very briefly, so the firm that I was associated with has been around for over 100 years, and it has about 300, more than 300 people, not all lawyers. And part of the beauty of it, if I can call it that, is that it works throughout the continent of Africa, but also we do work for South African clients all over the world as well. So there's a very international flavor to doing intellectual property law, which appealed to me a lot. So intellectual property is the property of your mind. It is things that are created by your mind and for which you would like to have some protection and some exclusivity and to be able to exploit it. There are registered rights, and the main registered rights are trademarks, and I'll go into that a little bit more, patents and designs. Trademarks are the names of things or services. Patents protect the way things work, so maybe something that you can't see, the inside of your car engine or the inside of a mobile phone or the ingredients for a drug. And designs protects the way things look. So the shape of a lamp or the appearance of your cell phone, etc. The unregistered rights, you have something called copyright. So it comes into being as soon as you have created a work, which is defined by the Copyright Act. And that could be a piece of music, a book, a painting. The software is protected as copyright as well. So those are the unregistered, or copyright is the unregistered intellectual property mainly.
What do you mean by unregistered?
So you don't go to the government office and apply to register your right. So for a trademark, you apply to the trademarks office. For a patent, you apply to the patent office. And for a design, it's sort of joined in with the patents office. You register your rights. You define what your right is. So if it's a trademark, it's maybe a word. And you say what it's going to be used for and who the owner is. For the patent, you've got to actually describe the invention, which has to be new in the whole world. So if you see something in America, you can't come back here and file a patent for it. So you've got to come up with something completely new, novel and inventive, and solving a problem that has never been solved before. And the design, again, also has to have an element of novelty to it. So it can't be something that has been created before.
Okay, can I stop you there? We've got to pay the bills, and just for 1 minute, stay online, but I'll stop you there.
Adverts aren't meant to trick you or cause you harm. Report deceptive or offensive ads to the Advertising Regulatory Board. Visit arb.org.za to file your complaint. We respond to every complaint we receive. Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Hi, you're with Michael Bagram every Tuesday evening between 6 and 7. Please tune in. We speak to interesting people, and tonight we are having a chat, a fireside chat with attorney Stephen Goldberg, an old friend of mine, not old, but a good friend, long-term friend of mine, who's been describing a little bit about his career in intellectual property law. At Spoor & Fisher, the firm Spoor & Fisher. I even had the pleasure of visiting him one day at that firm, and for my trouble, I got a piece of cake, so thank you for that. I don't think I ever thanked you for it, but I do thank you for it. And he's going through some of the interesting things that he just describing to me what it actually does, because I've never understood it. But there's trademarks, patents, designs, and then there's copyright. And he's busy going through what the differences are. I used to all mix them all together, just calling it intellectual property. But he's busy describing to us what it actually is. I just want to tell one little anecdotal story, if you don't mind, Stephen. We had went out for dinner one evening. I think we were in Johannesburg with you and your good wife and some other friends. And around the dinner table, Patsy, my wife, said that she had seen a movie which she found fascinating and interesting. And you turned to her, you were sitting next to her, and said, but the movie hasn't been released yet. So there were a lot of red faces around the table. I don't know if you recall the evening. But she started backtracking very quickly. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yes, Bags. So that films are protected by copyright. And the producers of those films are very protective of their rights. And when they launch them or they give platforms the right to broadcast their films, they would prefer to earn an income from that. And so when there are other platforms that show these movies or share these films or music for that matter, where the original producers or artists are not receiving their royalties, you know, it is something that, you know, our firm would get involved in helping people to do that. So I prefer people not to tell me these stories, but I have a very embarrassing story to tell you of my own.
And I'd love to hear it.
It involved a games, the computer games, or kind of PlayStation games. And very, very, very early on in my career, I was traveling in Thailand, and there were games for sale. And it was amazing because they were sold for 30 Rand instead of for 300 Rand, for example. So I bought a couple of these games to bring back. But when I put them into my machine for my children, actually, not for me, it didn't work. And the only way you could get it to work was to go to some dodgy shop who then took your machine and put a chip into it or something that would make it work. But that was clearly illegal and an infringement of the copyright in the games themselves.
Okay, so you had your own red face episode.
Exactly, but I never repeated it.
Okay, well, I don't think Patsy ever did again either, but I must admit I had a good chuckle at the time with my head under the table, because she was boasting about how she'd just seen this movie. Just in terms of these things, when people do naughty things like that, did your firm ever get involved in litigation? Did you get in experts to come and describe why it wasn't legal, I suppose. Tell us a bit about how you got involved in that.
So what happens is that these registered rights give you exclusivity to use your property, whatever it may be. And you may use it yourself or you may license somebody else to use it. But where there is unauthorized use by third parties, they may be sued civilly for trademark infringement. They may also, if it is that bad, it's an imitation of the product, they may be counterfeit goods. And then what you do is you involve the commercial police to get involved, and you have investigators going into markets or into stores to look for these fake goods, and then you conduct a raid and you seize the goods, and you then the police institute a criminal action against the sellers or the importers, and or we may also issue a civil claim, so there might be a double action against those people. And then what also happens is at the ports, at the container ports and at the airports, the police look for counterfeit goods. They look at a manifesto or they open up somebody's suitcase and they find 200 pairs of jeans or 600 watches, or they find a container with thousands of bottles of whiskey. And there may be something that piques their suspicious minds. And what they do is they stop that. They will send a sample or photos of these products to the law firms acting for the original brand holders. And we, with the original brand holders, which are very often overseas, we will make a call as to whether these goods are genuine or not. And it's sometimes easy to see that there are very common errors that are made on the labeling or on the finishes of the products. And then the goods are confiscated until either the importer concedes to them being finally confiscated and they are then destroyed, or there's a full criminal case and or a civil case to have those goods confiscated.
Well, then it rings a bell in the sense that I was on holiday in Bali, of all places, and people tug your sleeve wherever you go, walking around the various beachfronts, and want to sell you a Rolex watch or all the other brand names that look unbelievably similar to the real thing, and they want to sell it to you for $5 or $10. They're pretty good watches. In fact, they last almost 6 months, and then they fall apart. But you can feel if you pick them up, you can feel it's not the weighty watch that you would feel on a Rolex. But it's so ubiquitous. It's just unbelievably everywhere. Whatever you want, you can find any piece of jewelry, any copy of anything you want. In countries like that, how do they even police that? I mean, this is openly done. In fact, sometimes you feel so obliged to buy it just to get rid of the salesman, you almost got no choice. It's you get badgered. I don't know if you've ever experienced anything like that.
So the same applies in South Africa. If you go to certain areas, Mabopane, Pretoria, or downtown Johannesburg, small street mall, you will find stores selling things that are clearly fake. If it costs 10% of what the market price is, it is probably not genuine, and there are going to be problems with the quality of the product. And if you have aspirations to have a Rolex watch, but you buy a fake Rolex, you will always know that it is not genuine and you couldn't afford the genuine product. And I'm not sure what it is that feeds the consumer's self-worth to have this fake item of clothing or whatever it is. But it gets much worse than that because you get fake spare parts. So, fake spare parts for airplanes, for example, that would probably fail. You also get fake pharmaceuticals. So people go online, they either do not have a medical aid or they cannot afford to buy the genuine drugs, and they go online and they see that there's a testing kit for diabetes, and they order it and they use it, but it does not work. So there is a lot of risk in buying some of these fake goods. As far as the clothing is concerned, it might have a colorant, it might cause irritation to your skin, and it might, not last as long as you would like it to, very shortly. And then the other thing is that a lot of these fake goods are done by criminal syndicates that are involved in a wide range of criminal activities, and the sale of these fake goods helps to fund those other much more serious criminal activities, including the sale of drugs, terrorism, trafficking in human beings, etc.
Well, look, I suppose either way it's wrong, because if it's not fake, then it's probably stolen if it's only 10% of the original amount, which is probably almost as bad, if not worse, than the fake goods itself. So you're going to land up with contraband either way. It's very seldom would you buy a Rolex watch at 10% if it's not fake or if it's not stolen. So the bottom line is, the real lesson is avoid it like the plague. I don't know what it is about my face, but I somehow attract people who want to sell me things at these strange things. It's normally fake. I've never seen anything real, but I can understand what you're saying, that even happens in Johannesburg, because it has happened to me there as well. I for one, I'm not a great brand person, and I've always shunned brands because I strongly feel that you're paying 10 times the price because you've got a name on it, whereas I can get something just as good that doesn't have the name on it. I remember for one of my sons, he wanted to have a pair of tackies with a big swoosh on it. And I bought him a pair of tackies at OK Bazaars at the time, and I painted on with a Kokie chalk the tick on the tackies. And somehow, even at the age of four, he realized that this wasn't the real thing. He was an expert at it at the age of four. And immediately there was a storm of tears, and he kept telling me he's not going to be able to run in those shoes because it didn't have the real thing on it. So I can understand what you're talking about, that people recognize that it's not the real thing. I'm being so, I don't know, negative about brands, suddenly in my later life, took up a hobby, in that I went out and bought myself a Harley Davidson for a midlife crisis, long after my midlife, but as a midlife crisis, I went and bought an Harley Davidson. And I'm now a slave to the brand, in that I can recognize immediately because I go to a lot of the rallies, around South Africa, and I know when a stall is setting up and going to be selling us Harley Davidson gear, either helmets or gloves or t-shirts or whatever, I know by even just a glance that that's not the real thing. But there are adherents to brands that will know it and will never buy, not because it's illegal, but because it's their own feelings. I don't know if you ever came across that sort of feeling from people that they would never have something that's fake,
Yes,
not
I
because
think,
of the illegality.
I think some people feel very strongly about it. They want the real thing. And it's important to them to know that they're getting that value. The brand has a lot of identity, if I can call it that, where you make an association with a certain value. So you're getting that value, you're getting the message that is conveyed by the brand itself. And there isn't a thing that is sold or a service that is offered that doesn't have a brand on it. And even my name, like Stephen Goldberg, it's my personal brand, except there are five other Stephen Goldbergs, but there's nothing I can do about that. But it is your name is your
Impersonators.
brand, your image is your brand, and there's some very strange things. There's even things like you call it like a position brand. So, for example, Usain Bolt's The way he stands and points when he won his amazing races and broke records, that has been protected as part of his brand for clothing or something like that. But it just all of those things become important and valuable. And brands become very valuable, all intellectual property, including patents. So they become very valuable assets for companies. And whenever a company is sold and a due diligence is done and evaluation is given to the brands, that is part of what is being sold. And companies build up very large portfolios of assets which are made up of the intellectual property. So what is Coca-Cola? Coca-Cola is the recipe which they've managed to keep a secret. They have trucks and they have factories, and those are the physical things that are there. But the most valuable thing that exists for that brand is the trademark itself. So that's why it's important for it to be protected. They protect the word Coca-Cola. They protect the logo, so that classical writing of the word Coca-Cola and the red and white combination as it appears on its packaging. All of those things are part of the trademark and are protected very often as separate elements.
Well, going back again to the Harley-Davidson brand, at these rallies where we have the reaction from the Harley-Davidson riders are there when someone is selling a fake T-shirt, for instance. Well, we just had this recently, last week, in fact, someone was selling fake T-shirts. He was asked to leave, not because, again, not because anyone's an adherent to the law. There were some very naughty people there, but they just didn't want anyone wearing a T-shirt that was not real. Like they said, it's just not real, and he was asked to leave the gathering, which I found rather interesting. What we're going to do now, we're going to cut for a break, but if you could log off and then log back on again in 2 minutes' time, we're just going to have a quick ad break again.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Hi, thank you for joining us again. It's Michael Bagram every Tuesday evening between 6 and 7 on Chai FM 101.9. Please tell us what you would like to hear, what you would like, which people you'd like to be interviewed. I'm always open for suggestions. Tonight we've got a wonderful guest, Stephen Goldberg, an attorney specializing in intellectual property, has been taking us through what it's all about. It's always been a mystery to me, and I know many of us have had the mystery, and it's slowly unraveling and telling us what it's about. Now, Stephen, just another small anecdotal story from me. A few years back, well, quite a long time ago, in fact, over 15 years again, I, at the end of the day, was doing some labor work. I've been doing labor work throughout my life and my legal life, and I was approached by attorneys in New York who act on behalf of Disney. They were putting on a show in Pretoria at the time, The Lion King. I don't know if you remember it. I think it was about 15 years ago. They were putting on the show. They had applied through their attorneys in New York to have work permits for young children who were going to be the young lions. They needed to train 16 young children. Young black children from Soweto. They had chosen which children they would be, and they needed to, excuse me about the cough, they needed to actually get these work permits. It got turned down, and the American attorneys, who were a little bit cocky, were indignant about this, but it put the whole show at risk, and they asked me to appeal these work permits that had been turned down to get them redone. I then started engaging with the attorneys about this, had to find out a little bit about Disney. I mean, we all know what Disney is, but I didn't understand the massive operations that they did run at the time. I made an application, and eventually I got those work permits for the children. I'm very excited about it. But they started telling me how they protect their brand, how Disney does it. They have networks throughout the world. Tentacles in not only in law but right across the business world. Disney is active, very active with police forces around the world, and in particular in South Africa. They had a very strong relationship and how protective they were of their brand, and telling me that they had a good working relationship with the South African police. And Stephen was telling us also a bit about that, about how the police do get involved in disputes of this nature. So I had a fascinating 3 or 4 days with the attorneys who flew to Pretoria to come speak to the Department of Labor with me. Stephen, I don't know if you've ever dealt with big companies like that, and have you dealt with companies of that nature?
So yes, Bags, this is an interesting segue, because Warren Fisher was very involved in a case with Disney. So we do act for a lot of the big corporations in enforcing their rights. But in this particular instance, there was a musician many years ago by the name of Solomon Linda,
yes,
who wrote some of the music, which we know today mainly as The Lion Sleeps Tonight. And it's been covered by many artists over many years, and including a portion of it, about 16 bars of the music, called Mbubi or Wimowe, appears in the Lion King movies and television shows and live productions. But what happened was that Solomon Linda had died, and his family were absolutely poverty stricken. And we were approached to see if there was anything that we could do for them. And what happened was that when he wrote this music, South Africa was still part of the British Commonwealth, but also I think we were even, we were independent from the UK, but we still used their copyright law. And their copyright law provided that after 20 years, the copyright in a work reverted back to the author. Now, Solomon already dead, but what we did is we he had transferred the right for like one penny to a music company. And so we reopened his estate, we appointed an executor and trustees, and we approached Disney and asked them. And this law only applied in British Commonwealth countries, so it wouldn't have applied in the US. So in the US, the copyright did not revert back to Solomon and all his heirs. So we approached Disney to ask them if they would pay some form of royalties to the family, which they declined to do.
And in that's interesting.
And in order to, I mean, you know, they had used it in absolute good faith. There was nothing that they knew that they had done wrong, and the permission to use the works had been obtained from whoever it was. But when those works were broadcast, produced, or shown outside of the US and or in a country like South Africa, then here they were now infringing the copyright in that piece of music. So in order to be able to sue them in South Africa and not be involved in heavy legal costs, for example, in the USA, because Disney is a USA company, we attached some of their trademarks inside, their registered trademarks in South Africa. So we attached the mouse and Donald Duck, and that was like waving a red flag to a bull. They tried to attack the reopening of the estate, etc. But after quite a lengthy battle and some negotiations, the matter was settled. Some funds were received, and the it was received into a trust for the family, and it's been managed for them. Our firm was not involved in that aspect of it, but we were very, one of my colleagues, Owen Dean, who is an expert on copyright law and wrote the textbook on the South African law of copyright, found this provision and acted in the matter, and we have a happy ending.
Well, that's a fairy tale for Disney, that's for sure. And unbelievable. They must have been happy as well at the end of the day that they'd helped the family out for a man that had, I mean, it's in every South African has it in his or her psyche. The Lion Sleeps Tonight. It's iconic, that's for sure.
Absolutely. It's used in so many different places as well.
And other big companies, I mean, obviously, you know, we're not a third world country. We're a first world country, and we must have, I mean, like I was talking about the Harley Davidson copyright. I suppose just about every single brand that we know, registered around the world, is available in South Africa, and probably every single brand has got its legalities attached to it.
Another very interesting area which trademarks touches on is comparative advertising. And in South Africa, you can't say this brand is better than another brand as part of your advertising, unless you can actually show how it is better. But one of the really very interesting advertisements that appeared was the Mercedes-Benz. Had a television advert or a film advert where it
I
drove
remember it so
around
well. Yeah. Well, tell us
exactly
about it.
around that the road from Cape Town
From
not
Hout Bay, from
Hout
Hout
Bay,
Bay.
and it
Yeah.
actually had a crash, but the person got out and survived because of how good the Mercedes-Benz was. And then BMW got very clever. And they drove on the same route, but their car didn't have a crash. And they then had the slogan, BMW beats the Benz, but spelt in the normal way, BENDS.
Yes, yeah. There
And
was a court case, wasn't there, about
there
that?
was a court case about it, and it was found to be kind of unfair comparative advertising. And then another really interesting thing that happens is around major sports events. Where you have something called ambush marketing, and where you fly your a competing brand, so not an official sponsor of
Can
the
I hold
event.
you? Can Because talk about
Yeah.
sponsors, we're going to have a quick ad break. Stay online, but one ad, 1 minute.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Hi, you're with Michael Bagram, Tuesday evening between 6 and 7. Please let us know who you want to hear from, and we'll hunt down that person like we hunted down Stephen Goldberg this evening, as well as attorney Stephen Goldberg, an intellectual property lawyer, taking us through some fascinating stories. We ended off just before hand. We were talking about the wonderful advert, and I remember it so well, where BMW came out and said, "We beat the Benz." And I know there was some litigation thereafter. In fact, during the ad break, I was just looking at some of the postings on my Facebook page, and already our listeners are sending in their comments about the brands that they love so much and how they want their brands protected, the brands that they use, what cars, what jerseys, shoes. It's unbelievable how it touches people's heart. And I was saying earlier that I'm not a person that enjoys or adheres to brand, but come the middle age, sort of late age crisis I had with Harley Davidson, all of a sudden I almost worship the brand. It's quite a weird concept for me, but I would never in a million years put on a t-shirt that said Harley Davidson and that didn't have the proper label stuck to the back of it. And I'm also one of those adherents saying that we must have goods made in South Africa, and yet I'm the first to import Harley Davidson gloves, helmet, shirt, jersey, pants, you name it. I mean, I like a teenager all over again. And Stephen Goldberg is telling us some of the fascinating stories. And Stephen, I cut into your story that you were just about to tell us just after the Beats the Benz. You had another anecdotal story you're going to tell us.
Thank you, Bags. So yes, I was going to talk to you about, I'm talking about to you about ambush marketing. So
Right.
the major sports events like the World Cups and the Olympics and everything else, they have official sponsors who pay to be affiliated with that event, and they get a lot of benefit out of doing that, of advertising on the t-shirts in the stadiums, etc. But there are competing companies who are not official sponsors who then get involved in ambush marketing. So what they do is they fly a blimp over the stadium with the competing brand on it, or an airplane with a banner behind it. Or they pay models, a big group of models, to wear a t-shirt with a competing brand. And then at a certain point during the game, they take off their jackets and they then present this thing. And they create quite a spectacle. And the TV cameras, will focus on them, etc. And the official sponsors become very upset when this happens, or even around the location of the event. People may set up stalls. So what happens is that the law has now something called protected events, and you may not be within a certain perimeter of that. And they will also once again have inspectors going, the official brand sponsors will have inspectors going around. If they see somebody, they will get the police involved and get those people removed. The models were arrested,
No.
but then eventually released without charge. But it did make front page news. And brand owners also need to be careful about being heavy-handed. And so in normal circumstances, you have sometimes the people complaining that they are the ones who are doing the wrong thing. So somebody may do a presentation to them, and then they come out with a new product and they complain. It's like David versus Goliath, that somebody has taken their idea and adopted it and used it. So you have this very careful balance that has to be achieved in protecting your rights, but doing it in a way that's not going to damage your brand.
Well, look, I mean, I remember that court case, it wasn't that long ago, with a person who had put together a juice that was being sold at Woolworths, and one of the small producers in one of the Karoo towns just outside Cape Town, that offered this juice to Woolworths, was never taken up. They then, by the looks of things, copied it. And then started selling it, and it looked very similar to the juice that was presented to them. It became a David and Goliath story, but eventually Woolworths did the right thing, if I remember correctly. They settled the case, they apologized, they had said that there was some sort of error, and they then made good with the people, who then they all shook hands, and there was a nice photo op with everyone settling this case. I don't know if you recall that. But it was to do with the fruit juice of some sort.
No, that is correct. And it was the look and feel of the label and the packaging on the juice and the different brand, the different flavors that they imitated. And then I see the time is getting short, but
Yeah,
very,
sure, getting very short, yeah.
very,
No.
very quickly, there's something else called geographical indications. And these are not brands, but it's things like feta, port, sherry, champagne, which have become protected. And that's why in South Africa, you don't have a locally bottled sparkling wine called champagne. It's called Méthode Cap Classique. So similarly, our rooibos and our Karoo Lamb have become protected geographical indications. So people overseas can't call their tea that is grown from a bush that is a rooibos bush that has not been grown and produced in South Africa.
Well, I have now the pleasure to say thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. It's been an absolute gem to listen to you this evening. Thank you. You opened up my mind as to everything intellectual property wise. And I appreciate, I've always valued our friendship, and I have valued the discussion this evening. And likewise, I want to, on behalf of everyone that was listening this evening, saying thank you for giving us of your time.
Thanks. Thank you very much. I also really appreciate it. It's a lot of fun. I've just scratched the surface. This has been my life. I've loved it. And it's just been special to spend this time with you and the listeners.
Thank you.